Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Regime change, does it work or not? I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your Christmas weekend with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
Here's a foreign policy issue that's sure to remain top of mind through the presidential campaign. Is America better off trying to change unfriendly governments or trying to contain them?
After watching their parents suffer through the Great Recession, millennials are gun-shy about financial advice. But there are some new and unconventional approaches.
Why some comedians refuse to perform on college campuses.
And why you can skip sit-ups during your workout.
Some people advocate sort of a modified setup, which is almost not a setup at all. Dr. Stuart McGill in Canada, who's done a lot of the research on the effects of sit-ups on the spine, advocates a modified curl-up in which you put your hands behind your lower back on the ground and barely lift your shoulder blades off the ground.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman on what's wrong with sit-ups and what you can do instead for that ab workout. She's here in about 10 minutes. Well, here's a foreign policy question that's certain to remain unanswered during the rest of the campaign for the White House. Is America better off trying to change unfriendly and dangerous governments or living with and containing them? Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Sibes says this question doesn't merely bedevil the nation's policymakers. It now splits the presidential candidates from both parties, as the recent Republican and Democratic debates showed. Jerry, is there a right or wrong answer?
Well, I don't think there is a clear-cut answer, which is why this is both an interesting debate and an important one in both parties, because, you know, the question is really kind of crystallized around President Assad of Syria, and the question basically is should the U.S. go in? The U.S. wants him gone, should it go in and make that happen? Or are you better off, even if you don't like somebody like Assad, containing him, living with him, and not risking the instability that comes with trying to change a country the way we tried to change Iraq by getting rid of Saddam Hussein, or the way Egypt was changed when Hosni Mubarak went away, or the way the West pushed out Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And the argument of the anti-regime change folks is that in every one of those cases, the instability that followed the regime change was worse for everybody in the region, but also worse for the U.S. In its national interests than what was happening before when the thug dictator bad guy was still in power. So that's the debate right now, and I guess the reverse case, which is made by people like Marco Rubio and to some extent Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, is that, you know, at some point you have to, if there's a dictator in place, he's alienating his own people, he's putting a lid on extremism, but if you let that go on for too long, it explodes, and that instability is worse than what you get with trying to change the government.
The debate, though, is really made for some strange bedfellows, right? You got odd partnerships within the Republican Party and then crisscrossing with Republicans, Democrats seemingly agreeing on a position.
Yeah, I mean, you have basically a situation here which, on this question of regime change and is it worth it or not, you have Bernie Sanders on the Democratic left and Rand Paul on the Republican libertarian right in agreement, and Ted Cruz to some extent, and Donald Trump to some extent, voicing doubts about whether the U.S. should be going in and doing these kinds of things, and whether the results of the last decade when we've attempted to push out leaders who were seen as bad for the U.S., whether the results have been worse than the disease they were supposed to cure.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Sibes. His piece is entitled Regime Change, Good or Bad? The Question Splits the Parties. I think with a lot of the debates, you know, if you pay half attention to some of the issues, right, you can pretty much counter what one candidate is saying about a particular issue and know the basic talking points. But when it comes to regime change, I found myself watching that Republican debate. Every time somebody said something, I thought, yeah, that's a good point. And then somebody else would say the opposite. I thought, well, that's a good point, too.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I think that makes you a typical American, I suppose. I don't think people know what to think here. They want the U.S. to be assertive and to be in charge, if that's the right term, of its own interests around the world. But as President Obama has figured out, they're not really wild about launching into another Iraq-like situation where the change the U.S. wants also comes along with a price tag of having to basically send tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of troops in and be engaged on the ground in a messy effort for a decade to try to clean things up afterwards. And that's the problem. That's a problem for those who don't want to have regime change, and it's a problem for those who do want to have regime change, which is that there's not a really clear, obvious answer either in terms of what works best or what the American people really want.
Is it possible then that the answer to whether or not regime change is beneficial varies country by country?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the situations are all different. You know, for example, if you look at what happened in Egypt, I don't think that was a case in which the U.S. pushed out Hosni Mubarak per se, but it didn't really rise to his defense when he was being threatened. And so, in a sense, the U.S. kind of let regime change happen, and then people have been unhappy with the outcomes, both because in the short term the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, and in the long run a military leader came back in and has been pretty authoritarian. And so lots of people on both sides of the equation have been unhappy with the results. It's different from, you know, what happened in Libya, where the U.S. and NATO actually went in and used air power to kind of force out Muammar Gaddafi, who was ultimately killed, and that the result there was supposed to be democracy in elections, which in fact did happen, but people haven't abided by the results and chaos has ensued. And so, you know, you have different situations in Libya and Egypt, though they sit right next to each other, and very different outcomes. Egypt has got a very firm authoritarian hand at the top, and Libya just sort of has chaos. In each case, regime change doesn't necessarily produce happy results, but the problems are quite different.
Thanks, Jerry. It's Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. 13 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Good news if you love fitness but hate sit-ups. The age-old exercise may be going the way of the dinosaurs. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman says people from high-profile exercise gurus to military experts are arguing that the sit-up presents too great a risk of back injury. Rachel, is it having those hands behind your head and pulling on your neck?
That's part of it. It's also really just the compression and weight on the spine as you're curling up is really the damaging part. And we probably all felt that pinch here and there, especially when we're not warmed up. You know, this doesn't necessarily bother everybody, but it certainly is a potential risk, as some research has shown.
All right. Well, if you're in the military, right, you're always ingrained in your head, like, I don't know, what do they have to do, 50 in a minute or 60 in a minute, something like that. What's the preferred way to do an exercise like that without sort of giving up on it wholeheartedly?
Well, some people advocate sort of a modified sit-up, which is almost not a sit-up at all. Dr. Stuart McGill in Canada, who's done a lot of the research on the effects of sit-ups on the spine, advocates a modified curl-up in which you put your hands behind your lower back on the ground and barely lift your shoulder blades off the ground and just hold that for about 10 seconds and do that several times. Other people say, you know what, just scrap that whole position and get into plank pose, which is essentially like the up push-up position, and hold your body rigid. It'll take all of your ab and core muscles to hold that position for a period of time.
Do you do a version of that? You probably like the planks, right? I'm into the planks a little bit as part of the routine.
Yeah, I think the planks are great, especially because you can go from push-ups to planks to, you know, side plank. There's a lot of different variations you can do on it. So I kind of like that about it, too. You can kind of, like, I sometimes lean from sort of side to side to kind of tax one side of the abs and then the other. So there are a lot of different things you can do with it, and then you can move to another position pretty easily. The sit-up, you know, it's just not a position we're in very often. That's one of the reasons why people criticize it. It's not like a position that military personnel, for instance, need to get into typically. So it's not terribly indicative of the kind of things you can do in your job.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. She's got a piece entitled "Why You Can Stop Doing Sit-Ups." You pointed out that at least one part of the Canadian military has gotten away from that also. Don't they do something with sandbags instead?
Yes, they've actually scrapped sort of the old school exercises completely, and it's the Canadian Armed Forces. And what they're trying to do is replicate the kinds of moves that soldiers will be called upon to do in their call of duty. And so, in fact, someone at the Canadian Armed Forces mentioned that not long ago, some soldiers had to sandbag at a flood area. And so lifting a sandbag repeatedly is something you probably need to be able to do and to demonstrate that you can do. So that's one example of sort of a more functional exercise that some of these sort of uniform tests are going to.
So what are the branches of our armed forces going to do? Are they actually looking at doing something different from the sit-up?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, three of the four major armed forces are currently reviewing their physical fitness test elements, and they're not necessarily looking just at the sit-up, but there's an article and an editorial actually in Navy Times newspaper that advocated kicking out the sit-up from the physical fitness test, among other changes that they recommended. And so this is definitely under consideration. And in fact, I spoke with a physical education expert at the U.S. Naval Academy who advocates replacing the sit-up with plank pose, if they do retain sort of an abdominal core exercise in the fitness test, they might overhaul it completely and insert these more functional kinds of tasks instead of the traditional kind of calisthenics that we have become familiar with.
Right. Wow. All right. So what about like a traditional sit-up on an exercise ball? Is that any less stressful on the spine than, say, just doing them on a floor?
Some experts say that you really should avoid that curl-up motion, that repeated curling motion, because over time that can really cause some damage on your back. So other people do them their whole life and don't have a problem. So I think the consensus is not there yet. But some people would say it's better just to avoid that curling motion altogether if you can. And there are a number of sort of replacement ab exercises that you can do that, the sit-up is really not vital. You don't need to do it to strengthen your abdominal muscles.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, who's based in New York. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hope you had a great Christmas. Are you ever at a holiday party with people who never seem intoxicated or obviously addicted, yet they drink a ton of booze? They may have additional problems. Experts say alcohol-related brain damage is underdiagnosed. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
How much drinking is too much, and what are the effects? Here to break down the latest on this somewhat controversial topic is Melinda Beck of the Wall Street Journal. Melinda, let's start with some of the basics first. What's the definition, the latest definition of heavy drinking?
So government researchers say that anything over 4 drinks per day for men or 14 drinks per week or 3 drinks for a woman or 7 drinks per week is really too much. And you have to stay within both of those limits so that you can't save up all of your drinks and have them one day of the week, because that will get you into trouble. But you also shouldn't go over that weekly limit, because you can set yourself up for a long-term health effect.
Are the guidelines the same for everyone?
No, they're not. Everybody is really different, and it does matter by sex. If you're over age 65, you should really keep it under 2 or 3 per day, whether you're a man or a woman. And again, don't go over 7 during the week.
For a heavy drinker, then, what are some of the harms of drinking heavily?
Increasingly sophisticated brain scanning technology is really showing experts the kind of damage that can be caused in the brain that they've only had to guess at in the past. And they're seeing that not only do brain cells shrink with chronic heavy drinking, but also so do the white matter fibers that connect one part of the brain to the other. And some of the worst damage happens in the frontal lobe, which is sort of where impulse control lives, which is sets up a vicious circle, because the very part of your brain that you need to recognize that you're drinking too much and change your habits is one of the first to be damaged.
There's so much news about Alzheimer's these days, and we hear about more and more people with dementia. Are they saying now, researchers, that some of this is tied to alcoholism or alcoholic?
There are lots of different kinds of dementias, and people tend to think of them all as Alzheimer's. But the kind of damage that long-term alcohol abuse does is more like cerebrovascular dementia, which happens when the brain really gets starved of blood and oxygen. And it tends to affect cognitive ability more than memory. Again, people lose the ability to reason and control impulses and learn new things. as opposed to having real memory deficits.
What's alcohol's impact on depression and stress?
You know, depression there too has always been a vicious circle. People who are depressed have a high risk of alcoholism and vice versa, and it's been hard to know which came first. But new research has also shown that long-term alcohol abuse can really disrupt the connection between, again, the frontal lobes and the amygdala, which is the brain's sort of seat of emotion, so that you lose control over your emotions. You know, at one point you've got your arm around your buddy, and the next moment you're bursting out crying. And they've also seen some of the same damage that it's almost like post-traumatic stress disorder, that you can get in a long-term state of anxiety and not be able to calm down, also because you've damaged the connection between the frontal lobes and that emotional seat.
Melinda, do researchers think this can be reversed? You know, we heard a lot about smokers. If they stopped, then things would get better for them. If you stop drinking, will some of these bad things go away?
That is the good news. And unlike other forms of dementia that are really more degenerative, this kind of damage can be reversed, particularly if you really stop drinking and get hold of your drinking patterns, particularly before age 50. That seems to be a kind of a Rubicon there, that really heavy drinking after age 50, you're less likely to reverse that if you stop. And it may just be that the brain loses its ability to find new pathways and repair that damage.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal health writer Melinda Beck. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. We'd love to welcome a new sponsor to the show, All and Sundry, a modern men's shoe company with an old-world vision. My friend Nick and his team make the finest handcrafted custom shoes, shoes your grandfather would be proud of. All and Sundry creates a unique experience where you select your style of shoe, whether for work or play. Then you choose the material, add custom features like eye stays, then select a color. They source all the materials and build each one by hand. Without a middleman, you get the savings. No more outrageous markups. If you're a shoe guy, All and Sundry is for you. If you're not, you might change your mind after seeing All and Sundry. Right now, get a 10% discount on a gift card for the holidays. Visit allandsundry.com and enter the promo code DEAL at checkout. That's AWL and sundry.com. Then enter DEAL at checkout. All and Sundry, stylish and modern shoes with craftsmanship a grandfather would be proud of. Again, allandsundry.com and enter code DEAL. More proof about how college campuses are much different from the ones we roamed back in the day. Comedians like Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld have said they don't play college shows anymore because the audiences are too easily offended. Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin says schools now often have contracts that forbid performers from using certain words or even broaching entire subjects. Doug, what's with Seinfeld?
His comedy is sort of, you know, observational. It's not particularly racial or at least the stuff that I've seen. So it tells you, I think, a little bit about the climate that he perceives on campuses. And Chris Rock said the same thing. I think they just said the rules of what's acceptable and not acceptable on college campuses, as far as they're concerned, has made it really, I think, no fun to play play in front of those audiences. And this has become an issue throughout the profession, the comedian profession. But these places pay well as far as stand-up comedy gigs go, between $1,000 and $2,000. So if you can make that circuit, it can bring in solid money. So you try to adjust your act. But adjusting your act is becoming, I think, increasingly hard for these guys.
What's happened on college campuses, Doug? These venues used to be the haven for the likes of Lenny Bruce and George Carlin in years past.
You know, it's a big question. A lot of things are happening and converging at the same time. First of all, the universities have changed. The demographics on college campuses have shifted, you know, from even 20 years ago significantly. Second of all, I think there's broadly more anxiety and anger on college campuses. A lot of tracing back to the financial issues, these kids, this is no longer a ticket to the middle class. It may be a ticket to penury, depending on what you study and how much debt you get into. So there's a lot of stress on kids like that. And then, you know, this is, I think, to some extent, the consequences of identity politics that have just evolved from the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, and everybody's got a place and a identity, and there are lines being drawn about what you can and can't say to folks within those identities.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin. He's got a piece entitled, "For Stand-Up Comedians, Shows on Campus Are Often No Joke." You hit on what a comedian can make on a college campus. So how are they being hurt financially?
Well, these guys go through tryouts, and they have to essentially get selected by and almost approved by an association of student affairs folks. And if they make the cut, if they like their work, if they think their work is appropriate for college kids, and you know their job is to help create a positive experience for the university, and they don't want to bring somebody on campus who's going to, their fear is that it would create a negative atmosphere or make fun of people beyond what's acceptable. Where that line is where the issue is. You know, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, and it's moving, and it's narrowing. One of the folks we spoke to was the troupe of Second City, which is a big improv organization here in Chicago where I'm based, and they sent a lot of folks to SNL, and they're really famous. They used to have two shows that they would put on the road, and they would send one to performing arts centers and one to college campuses. The one that they sent to college campuses was edgier and darker, and that's no longer the case. They were getting complaints about kids feeling insecure or not happy about what they were hearing from these comedians, so they've really ratcheted it back.
Comedians are trying to find their way in 2015. You wrote that they're using something called tester jokes to feel out the audience. Can you elaborate?
I don't know if that's new. I think that's been going on for a while. I think the stakes are rising for what those tester jokes tell the comedian about the audience they're playing. So they'll, you know, what some of these comedians that I interviewed said was that they would, if they were going to riff on a joke on race or gender or sexuality, they would use themselves as a punching bag to sort of start. They would be the butt of the joke, and then if the audience thought that was funny, if they didn't think that there was something untoward about that, then they would move on towards something that might be a little more closer to the edge. But they're very cautious, and a number of them said, if you get taped, you know, everybody's got an iPhone now, and if there's a video of you making a joke that crosses the line, your career can be really screwed. So there's a lot of self-censorship and there's a lot of fear in the comedian class to make sure that they don't end up on the wrong side of BuzzFeed.
Man, how far we've come, right? Wow. Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin. It's 21 minutes now before the hour. After getting a front row seat for the Great Recession and saddling themselves with student debt, few millennials right now are in the mood or in a position to seek out a traditional financial advisor. But MarketWatch reporter Jillian Berman says they need financial advice just the same. She's got a look at the arrival of new and unconventional approaches that try to help 20 and 30-somethings to start saving and investing. Jillian, what have you found?
This story sort of focused on the different places that millennials turn to for financial advice. And that quote that you drew out is, you know, basically one of the most common questions that one of the financial advisors we spoke to get. Basically, you know, that's kind of their biggest concern. How long will I be paying off my student loans? Can I do anything else with my money, you know, before I die, basically?
All right. So this is a group, obviously, as we've been reading about, has a lot of student debt. They're also coming off the recession, which they probably watched their parents go through. What is this group's mindset?
There's sort of a lot holding them back financially, right? They have a lot of debt, like we discussed. And then, you know, they maybe graduated from college during sort of a weak economy, and so they might have struggled to find jobs that paid them, you know, decent wages. And then on top of that, they saw their parents lose a ton of money during the Great Recession. And so even when they do have money to stash away, they kind of just put it in places where it doesn't work for them. So, you know, a savings account or something like that instead of investing it and trying to, you know, kind of make more money off that money.
What are these folks that do, these today's young adults, the 20s and 30s? They have, as you point out, some tools to help them start get saving and investing, but what, they're reluctant?
Yeah, so there's a lot of tools out there. There are apps, there are sort of social clubs and financial advisors who are really specifically focused on the demographics to help them. And a lot of what those groups start out with is just, you know, sort of building behaviors to get young people to save. And after that, maybe once they get used to that behavior, maybe if they've saved up enough, then they can start sort of accumulating wealth off of what they save.
With regards to the amount of, say, student debt they have, are they at all seeing a way out?
Levels of student debt are growing, but, you know, the average borrower has somewhere around between $25,000 and $30,000, basically. And if you graduated with a bachelor's degree, if you finished school, you know, that's a manageable amount of debt. And so what some of these, you know, these sort of advisors and things like that are trying to get borrowers to see is that you, here's how much you're going to have to pay a month. If you pay this much a month for this long, eventually that debt will go away. Maybe, you know, decades later, unfortunately, but it is going to go away. You know, there is a way out of it.
We're speaking with Jillian Berman, reporter at MarketWatch. Her piece is entitled Millennials Despair. Will I be paying student loans until the day I die? All right, so who's doing what? You mentioned Northwestern Mutual has a program.
Yeah, so Northwestern Mutual has a website called the Mint Grad, which basically features sort of younger voices, young personal finance experts blogging. And so that can be really relatable for this demographic because they're dealing with different financial issues than what their parents are dealing with. One of their competitors, MassMutual, has an entirely separate physical space that has kind of a, you know, a social club vibe. It's called Society of Grownups. And their 20 and 30-somethings can go to, they can meet with a financial advisor one-on-one, kind of like your traditional situation, or they can take, you know, classes that are over dinner and wine about the similarities between a good investment and a fine wine, or get trips on travel hacking, all sorts of things to kind of make this stuff a little bit more approachable.
Thanks, Jillian. It's MarketWatch reporter Jillian Berman.
You appreciate the feeling of a clean, smooth shave from a quality blade. So why are you messing around with generic razors that cost $32 for an 8-pack when you can shave with Harry's high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price? Harry's will give you their starter set, complete with a razor, three of their world-famous blades, and shaving cream for just $15. And shipping is always free. We'll also give you $5 off your first order. So go to harrys.com right now and enter code 7799 at checkout. Code 7799.
More robots are replacing humans on the job, as you know, but this time, and with this example, with pushback. Not full-on robots, but sometimes just mannequins with motorized signs. Wall Street Journal reporter Jack Nickus says businesses are deploying such contraptions to lure customers to car washes, pizza joints, and pawn shops. Part of the march of machines replacing human workers, but this step of the march is proving complicated. Jack, explain.
So this is the latest example of job automation in the U.S. You know, we've seen robots in factories. We've seen robots even writing news stories. But now we've got robots that are taking one of the simpler jobs in America, and that is those guys who stand roadside and wave signs trying to get you into a pawn shop or a pizza parlor. These are kind of motorized mannequins with rotating signs attached to their midsection. And a lot of people mistake them for humans. But what's happening in Los Angeles, where they're most popular, is the companies that are employing these robots are encountering vandalism. The robots are being stolen. Governments are fining the companies for using them. And yes, in some cases, they're losing their heads.
Got it. Are these like sidewalks outside of local shops or where?
Well, certainly in terms of geography, the heaviest concentration is in San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, sort of Van Nuys and everything, where there's a lot of strip malls and things like that, and cell phone repair shops and pizza places and car washes and pawn shops. And so if you drive around that neighborhood, as I did a few weeks ago, you see them kind of dotting the different avenues, and they will be sort of out on the sidewalk. They'll be either, you know, right outside the store. There'll be even a block down advertising, you know, car wash down the street. So they're kind of all over the place, but they all look pretty similar. And basically they're about 6'2", you know, blonde or brunette, curvy women. And, you know, usually having a similar rotating model with the sign. And the reason for that is there's only a couple of companies who sell them, and most of them are based in Los Angeles as well.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jack Nickus about motorized mannequins and how they can help and also get hurt along the way. So explain, I guess, some of the vandalism too. You say the one mannequin like had tattoos all of a sudden one day, up and down an arm.
Yeah, so many of the companies that I've spoke to that use these things said that they've had, you know, wasn't as easy as they thought it would be. You know, one guy at a smoke shop in Koreatown in L.A. said, you know, every day he would come out and the thing would be, you know, written on, or the wig would be ripped off, or the clothes would be gone. And one day he came out and the mannequin was missing an arm, and that's when he said, you know what, I'm done with this. We've got another guy at a legal services firm in Van Nuys who came out and the mannequin was missing her head. A nearby tax firm had lost two robots within a year. And another one, an insurance agency, had issues with their mannequin. They ripped The woman said that they ripped off the eyelashes, they took her earrings, they stole her shoes. But still, she said, even with that, and the thing is not really in good shape, she said it's still doing a better job than the mannequin's predecessor, which was a human.
Thanks, Jack. Wall Street Journal reporter Jack Nickas. How about that? 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Great story of perseverance. It comes from For the Win, a blog site at USA Today. It's about Joe Anderson, who was looking to regain a position on an NFL team. He was desperate for work, needing to feed his family, so he picked up a piece of cardboard and wrote a message that read, quote, "Not homeless, but starving for success." Put on his sneakers, drove over to the Houston Texans practice facility, stood outside and waited. Weeks later, still nothing. But this past week, the New York Jets called and signed Anderson to a spot on at least their practice squad. He's not the first, by the way, to be proactive like that. Defensive back Shiloh Keough was unemployed for much of the season. And when the Denver Broncos picked up a player that was not him, he sent a tweet to Wade Phillips saying, "Didn't want to pick me up, huh?" Phillips responded with an explanation why he looked elsewhere, but a week later, Keough got the call, played in a couple of games. In late July, LaVance Taylor was signed to the Chiefs after tweeting over a highlight reel. There you go, perseverance. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer, I'm Gordon. Thanks for listening.